Chapter 40. Dawn was coming up, painting the eastern sky a delicate rose color. Stu Redman and Glenn Bateman were about halfway up Flagstaff Mountain in West Boulder, where the first foothills of the Rockies rise up out of the flat plains like a vision of prehistory. In the dawn light, Stu thought that the pines crawling between the naked and nearly perpendicular stone faces looked like the veins ridging some giant's hand that had poked out of the earth. "I'm going to have a headache this afternoon," Glenn said. "I don't believe I've stayed up drinking all night since I was an undergrad." "Sunrise is worth it," Stu said. "Yes, it is. Beautiful." Stu hoisted the jug of wine and had a swallow. "I got quite a buzz on myself." He looked out over the view in silence for a few moments, and then turned to Glenn with a slanted smile. "What's going to happen now?"
"Happen?
Sure. That's why I got you up here. Told Franny I'm going to get him good and drunk and then pick his brains. She said fine." Glenn grinned. "There are no tea leaves in the bottom of a wine bottle. So, make some educated guesses. Cross my palm with silver, O aspirant to knowledge." "Never mind the silver, Baldy. I'll take you down to the First National Bank of Boulder tomorrow and give you $1 million. How's that?" "Seriously, Stu, what do you want to know?" "Same things that mute guy Andros wants to know, I guess. What's going to happen next? I don't know how to put it any better than that." "There's going to be a society," Glenn said slowly. "What kind? Impossible to say right now. There are almost 400 people here now. I'd guess from the rate they've been coming in, more every day, that by the 1st of September there'll be 1,500 of us. 4,500 by the 1st of October, and maybe as many as 8,000 by the time the snow flies in November and closes the roads. Write that down as prediction number one."
"Hard for me to believe," Stu said. "We came all the way across the country and didn't see 100 people all told."
"Ralph's in touch with 5 or 6 groups right now that will bring us up to 500 by the end of the week," Glenn said, and smiled again. "Mother Abigail sits right there with him in his radio station, but she won't talk on the CB. Says she's afraid she'll get an electroshock." "Franny loves that old woman," Stu said. "Part of it is because she knows so much about delivering babies, but part of it is just loving her, you know? Yes, most everybody feels the same." 8,000 people by winter," Stu said. "Man, oh man. It's just arithmetic. Let's say the flu wiped out 99% of the population. Maybe it wasn't that bad, but let's use that figure just so we have a place to put our feet. If the flu was 99% fatal, that means it wiped out damn near 218 million people just in this country." He looked at Stu's shocked face and nodded grimly. "Maybe it wasn't that bad, but we can make a pretty good guess that figure's in the ballpark. Makes the Nazis look like pikers, doesn't it?" "My lord," Stu said in a dry voice. "But that would still leave over 2 million people, 1/5 of the pre-plague population of Tokyo, 1/4 of the pre-plague population of New York. That's in this country alone. Now, I believe that 10% of that 2 million might not have survived the aftermath of the flu. People like poor Mark Braddock with his burst appendix, but also the accidents, the suicides, yes, and murder, too. That takes us down to 1.8 million. But we suspect there's an adversary, don't we? The dark man that we dreamed about, west of us somewhere. There are 7 states over there that could legitimately be called his territory, if he really exists."
"I guess he exists all right," Stu said.
"My feeling, too. But is he simply in dominion of all the people over there? I don't think so. Any more than Mother Abigail is automatically in dominion of the people in the other 41 continental United States. I think things have been in a state of slow flux. That state of affairs is beginning to end. People are cohering. When you and I first discussed this back in New Hampshire, I envisioned dozens of little tin pot societies. What I didn't count on, because I didn't know about it, was the all but irresistible pull of these two opposing dreams. It was a new fact that no one could have foreseen."
Are you saying that we'll end up with 900,000 people and he'll end up with 900,000?
No. First, the coming winter is going to take its toll. It's going to take it here. It's going to be even tougher for the small groups that don't make it here before the snow. You realize we don't even have one doctor in the free zone yet. Our medical staff consists of a veterinarian and Mother Abigail herself, who's forgotten more valid folk medicine than you or I will ever have a chance to learn. Still, they'd look cute trying to put a steel plate in your skull after you took a fall bashed in the back of your head, wouldn't they? Stu snickered. That old boy Rolf Dannemont would probably drag out his Remington and let daylight through me. I'd guess the total American population might be down to 1.6 million by next spring, and that's a kind estimate. Of that number, I'd like to hope we get the million. Boulder couldn't hold them. I know that boggles the mind when you walk around the empty streets downtown and out toward Table Mesa, but it just couldn't. We'd have to seed the communities all around us. The situation you'd have is this one giant community and the rest of the country east of here absolutely empty. Why do you think we'd get most of the people? For a very unscientific reason, Glenn said, riffling his tonsure of hair with one hand. I'd like to believe most people are good, and I believe that whoever is running the show west of us is really bad. But I have a hunch, he trailed off. Go on, spill it. I will because I'm drunk. But it stays between us, Stuart. All right. Your word?
My word, Stu said.
I think he's going to get most of the techies, Glenn said finally. Don't ask me why, it's just a hunch. Except that tech people like to work in an atmosphere of tight discipline and linear goals, for the most part. They like it when the trains run on time. What we've got here in Boulder right now is mass confusion. Everyone bopping along and doing his own thing. And we've got to do something about what my students would have called getting our shit together. But that other fellow, I'll bet he's got the trains running on time and all his ducks in a row. And techies are just as human as the rest of us. They'll go where they're wanted the most. I've a suspicion that our adversary wants as many as he can get. Fuck the farmers, he'd just as soon have a few men who can dust off those Idaho missile silos and get them operational again. Ditto tanks and helicopters, and maybe a B-52 bomber or two just for chuckles. Right now, he's probably still concentrating on getting the power back on, re-establishing communications. Maybe he's had to indulge in a purge or two. Rome wasn't built in a day, and he'll know that. He has time. But when I watch the sun go down at night, and this is no shit, Stuart, I get scared. I don't need bad dreams to scare me anymore. All I have to do is think of them over there on the other side of the Rockies, busy as little bees. What should we be doing? Should I give you a list? Glenn responded, grinning. Stuart took down a battered notebook with two disco dancers and the words Boogie Down on its hot pink cover. Yep, he said. You're kidding. No, I ain't. You said it, Glenn. We got to start getting our shit together someplace. I feel it, too. It's getting later every day. We can't just sit here jacking off and listen to the CB. We may wake up some morning to find that hard case waltzing into Boulder at the head of an armored column, complete with air support. Don't look for him tomorrow, Glenn said.
No. What about next May?
Possibly, Glenn said in a low voice.
Yes, quite possibly.
And what do you think would happen to us? Glenn didn't reply with words. He made an explicit little trigger-pulling gesture with the forefinger of his right hand, and then hurriedly scoffed the last of the wine.
Yeah, Stu said. So let's start getting it together. Talk.
Glenn closed his eyes. The brightening day touched his wrinkled cheeks and forehead.
Okay, he said. Here it is, Stu. First, recreate America. Little America. By fair means and by foul. Organization and government come first. If it starts now, we can form the sort of government we want. If we wait until the population triples, we're going to have grave problems. Let's say we call a meeting a week from today. That would make it August 18th. Everyone to attend. Before the meeting, there should be an ad hoc organization committee. A committee of seven, let us say. You, me, Andros, Fran, Harold Lauder, maybe. A couple more. The job of the committee would be to create an agenda for the August 18th meeting. And I can tell you right now what some of the items on that agenda should be. Shoot. First, reading and ratification of the Declaration of Independence. Second, R&R of the Constitution. Third, R&R of the Bill of Rights. All ratification to be done by voice vote.
Christ, Glenn, we're all Americans.
No, that's where you're wrong, Glenn said, opening his eyes. We're a bunch of survivors with no government at all, from every age group, religious group, class group, and racial group. What we've got going for us now is culture lag. Most of these people will still believe in government by representation, the republic, what they think of as democracy. But culture lag never lasts long. After a while, they'll wake up to the idea that the old ways are gone, and that they can restructure society any old way they want. We need to catch them before they wake up and do something nutty. He leveled his finger at Stu. If someone stood up at that August 18th meeting and proposed that Mother Abigail be put in absolute charge, with you and me and that fellow Andros as her advisors, those people would pass the item by acclamation, blissfully unaware that they had just voted the first operating American dictatorship into power since Huey Long. Oh, I can't believe that. There are college graduates here, lawyers, political activists. Maybe they used to be. Now they're just a bunch of tired, scared people who don't know what's going to happen to them. Some might squawk, but they'd shut up when you told them that Mother Abigail and her advisors were going to get the power back on in 60 days. No, Stu, it's very important that the first thing we do is ratify the spirit of the old society. That's what I meant about recreating America. It has to be that way as long as we're operating under direct threat of the man we're calling the adversary. Go on. All right. The next item on the agenda would be that we run the government like a New England township. Perfect democracy. As long as we're relatively small, it'll work fine. Only instead of a board of selectmen, we'll have 7 representatives, I guess. And we'll see to it that the people who get elected are the same people who were on the ad hoc committee. We'll put the rush on everybody and get the vote taken before people can do any tub-thumping for their friends. We can handpick people to nominate us and then second us. The vote will go through as slick as shit through a goose.
That's neat, Stu said admiringly.
Sure, Glenn said glumly. If you want to short-circuit the democratic process, ask a sociologist. What next? This is going to be very popular. The item would read, Resolved, Mother Abigail is to be given absolute veto power over any action proposed by the board.
Jesus, will she agree to that?
I think so. But I don't think she'll ever be apt to exercise her veto power, not in any circumstances I can foresee. We just can't expect to have a workable government here unless we make her its titular head. She's the thing we all have in common. We've all had a paranormal experience that revolves around her, and she has a kind of aura about her. People all use the same loose bunch of adjectives to describe her. Good, kind, old, wise, clever, nice. These people have had one dream that frightens the bejesus out of them, and one that makes them feel safe and secure. They love and trust the source of the good dream all the more because of the dream that frightened them. And we can make it clear to her that she's our leader in name only. I think that's how she'd want it. She's old, tired. Stu was shaking his head. She's old and tired, but she sees this problem of the dark man as a religious crusade, Glenn. You know that. You mean she might decide to take the bit in her teeth? Maybe that wouldn't be so bad, Stu remarked. After all, it was her we dreamed of, not a representative board. Glenn was shaking his head. No, I can't accept the idea that we're all pawns in some post-apocalypse game of good and evil, dreams or not. God damn it, it's irrational. Stu shrugged. Well, let's not get bogged down in it now. I think your idea of giving her veto power is a good one. In fact, I don't think it goes far enough. We ought to give her the power to propose as well as dispose. But not absolute power on that side of the slate, Glenn said hastily. No, her ideas would have to be ratified by the representative board, Stu said. And then added, we might find ourselves a rubber stamp for her instead of the other way around. There was a long silence. Glenn had put his forehead into one hand. At last he said, "Yeah, you're right. She can't just be a figurehead. At the very least, we have to accept the possibility that she may have her own ideas. And that's where I pack up my cloudy crystal ball, East Texas, because she's what those of us who ride the sociology range call other-directed." "Who's the other?" "It doesn't matter. What it means is that what she says won't necessarily be dictated by what this society needs or by what its mores turn out to be. She'll be listening to some other voice, like Joan of Arc. What you've made me see is that we just might wind up with a theocracy on our hands here."
"Theoc what?"
"On a god trip," Glenn said. He didn't sound too happy about it. "When you were a little boy, Stu, did you ever dream that you might grow up to be one of 7 high priests and or priestesses to a 108-year-old black woman from Nebraska?" Stu stared at him. Finally, he said, "Is there any more of that wine?"
"All gone."
"Shit." "Yes," Glenn said. They studied each other's faces in silence, and then suddenly burst out laughing. It was surely the nicest house Mother Abigail had ever lived in, and sitting here on the screened-in porch put her in mind of a traveling salesman who had come around Hemmingford back in 1936 or 37. Why, he'd been the sweetest-talking fellow she'd ever met in her life. He could have charmed the birdies right down from the trees. She had asked this young man, Mr. Donald King by name, what his business was with Abby Freemantle, and he had replied, "My business, ma'am, is pleasure. Your pleasure. Do you like to read? Listen to the radio, perchance? Or maybe just put your tired old dogs up on a foot hassock and listen to the world as it rolls down the great bowling alley of the universe?" She had admitted she enjoyed all those things, not admitting that the Motorola had been sold a month before to pay for 90 bales of hay. "Well, those are the things I'm selling," this sweet talker told her. "It may be called an Electrolux vacuum cleaner complete with all the attachments, but what it really is spare time. Plug her in and you open up whole new vistas of relaxation for yourself, and the payments are almost as easy as your housework's going to be." They had been deep in the Depression then, and she hadn't even been able to raise 20 cents for hair ribbons for her granddaughter's birthdays, and there was no chance for that Electrolux. But say, didn't that Mr. Donald King of Peru, Indiana, talk sweet? My! She had never seen him again, but she had never forgotten his name either. She just bet he had gone on to break some white lady's heart. She never did own a vacuum cleaner until the end of the Nazi War, when it seemed like all of a sudden anybody could afford anything, and even poor white trash had a Mercury hidden away in their back shed. Now this house in the Mapleton section of Boulder, Mother Abigail just bet there hadn't been many blacks living up here before the smiting plague, had every gadget she'd ever heard of, and some she hadn't. Dishwasher, 2 vacuums, one strictly for the upstairs work. Dispose all in the sink. Microwave oven. Clothes washer and dryer. There was a gadget in the kitchen, looked like nothing more than a steel box, and Nick's good friend Ralph Brentner told her it was a trash masher, and you could put about 100 pounds of swill into it and get back a little block of garbage about the size of a footstool. Wonders never ceased. But come to think of it, some of them had. Sitting, rocking on the porch, her eyes happened to fall on an electrical plug-in plate set into the baseboard. Probably so folks could come out here in the summer and listen to the radio or even have the baseball on that cute little round TV. Nothing in the whole country more common than those little wall plates with the prong slits in them. She'd even have them back in her squatter shack in Hemmingford. You didn't think nothing of those plates, unless they didn't work anymore. Then you realized that one hell of a lot of a person's life came out of them. All that spare time, that pleasure which the long-ago Don King had extolled her on, came out of those switch plates on the wall. With their potency taken away, you might as well use all those gadgets like the microwave oven and the trash masher to hang your hat and coat on. Say, her own little house had been better equipped to handle the death of those little switch plates than this one was. Here, someone had to bring her water fetched all the way from Boulder Creek. Back home, she'd had her own hand pump. Here, Nick and Ralph had had to truck up an ugly gadget called a portisan. They had put it in the backyard, At home, she'd had her own outhouse. She would have traded the Maytag washer-dryer combination in a second for her own washtub, but she had gotten Nick to find her a new one, and Brad Kitchener had found her a scrub board somewhere and some good old lye soap. They would get the power back on, of course. It was one of the things God had shown her in her dreams. She knew a goodish number of things about what was to come here, some from the dreams, some from her own good old common sense. The two were too intertwined to tell apart. Soon all these people would start pulling together. She was not a sociologist like that Glenn Bateman, who always eyed her like a racetrack ticket agent looking at a phony 10. But she knew that people always did pull together after a while. The curse and blessing of the human race was its chumminess. First, they'd want to form some sort of government, probably one they'd want to run around her. She couldn't allow that, of course, as much as she would like to. That would not be God's will. Let them run all the things that had to do with this earth. Get the power back on? Fine. First thing she was going to do was try out that trash masher. Get the gas running so they wouldn't freeze their behinds off this winter. Let them pass their resolutions and make their plans. That was fine. She would keep her nose right out of that part. She would insist that Nick had a part in the running of it, and maybe Ralph. That Texan seemed all right. He knew enough to shut off his mouth when his brains weren't running. She supposed they might want that fat boy, that Harold, and she wouldn't stop them, but she didn't like him. Harold made her nervous. All the time grinning, but the grin never touched his eyes. He was pleasant, he said the right things, but his eyes were like two cold flints poking out of the ground. She thought that Harold had some kind of secret, some smelly, nasty thing all wrapped up in a stinking poultice in the middle of his heart. She had no idea what it might be. It was not God's will for her to see that, so it must not matter to his plan for this community. All the same, it troubled her to think that fat boy might be a part of their high councils, but she would say nothing. Her business, she thought rather complacently in her rocker, her place in their councils and deliberations, had only to do with the dark man. He had no name, although it pleased him to call himself Flag, at least for the time being, and on the far side of the mountains, his work was already well begun. His goal was clear and simple, to destroy all of them. Her understanding of him was surprisingly sophisticated. The people who had been drawn to the Free Zone all came to see her in this place, and she received them, although they sometimes made her tired, and they all wanted to tell her that they had dreamed of her and of him. They were terrified of him, and she nodded and comforted and soothed as best she could. But privately she thought that most of them wouldn't know this Flag if they met him on the street, unless he wanted to be noticed. They might feel him, a cold chill, the kind you got when a goose walked over your grave, a sudden hot feeling like a fever flash, or a sharp and momentary drilling pain in the ears or the temples. But these people were wrong to think he had two heads, or six eyes, or big spike horns growing out of his temples. He probably didn't look much different than the man who used to bring the milk or the mail. She guessed that behind the conscious evil there was an unconscious blankness. That was what distinguished the Earth's children of darkness. They couldn't make things, but only break them. God the Creator had made man in his own image. That meant that every man and woman who dwelt under God's light was a creator of some kind, a person with an urge to stretch out his hand and shape the world into some rational pattern. The black man wanted, was able, only to unshape. Antichrist? You might as well say anti-creation. He would have his followers. He was a liar, and his father was the father of lies. He would be like a big neon sign to them, standing high to the sky, dazzling their sight with fizzing fireworks. They would not be apt to notice, these apprentice unshapers, that like a neon sign, he only made the same simple patterns over and over again. Some would make the deduction for themselves in time. His kingdom would never be one of peace. The sentry posts and the barbed wire at the frontiers of his land would be there as much to keep the converts in as to keep possible invaders out. Would he win? She had no assurance that he would not. She knew he must be as aware of her as she was of him. Nothing would give him more pleasure than to see her scrawny black body hung up to the sky on a cross of telephone poles for the crows to pick. But Would he win? That was not for her to know either. God worked discreetly, and in the ways that pleased him. It had pleased him to let the children of Israel sweat and strain under the Egyptian yoke for generations. It had pleased him to send Joseph into slavery, his fine coat of many colors ripped rudely from his back. It had pleased him to allow the visitation of 100 plagues on hapless Job, and it had pleased him to allow his only son to be hung up on a tree with a bad joke written over his head. God was a gamesman. If he had been a mortal, he would have been at home hunkering over a checkerboard on the porch of Pop Man's General Store back in Hemingford Home. He played red to black, white to black. She thought that, for him, the game was more than worth the candle. The game was the candle. He would prevail in his own good time, but not necessarily this year or in the next 1,000. And she would not overestimate her own place in the game any more than she would underestimate the dark man's craft and cozening. If he was neon gas, then she was the tiny dark dust particle a great rain cloud forms about over the parched land. Only another private soldier, long past retirement age, it was true, in the service of the Lord. "Thy will be done," she said, and reached into her apron pocket for a packet of Planters peanuts. They hurt her gums mortal bad, but my, weren't they tasty. As she munched, Ralph Brentner came up her walk, his hat with the feather in the band cocked back well on his head. As he tapped on the porch door, he took it off. "You awake, Mother?" "That I am," she said through a mouthful of peanuts. "Step in, Ralph, I ain't chewing these nuts, I'm gumming 'em to death." Ralph laughed and came in. "There's some folk out past the gate that'd like to say howdy if you ain't too tired. They just got in about an hour ago. A pretty good crew, I'd say. The fella in charge is one of these long hairs, but he seems well about it. Name's Underwood." "Well, bring him up, Ralph, that's fine," she said. "Good enough." He turned to go. "Where's Nick?" she asked him. "Haven't seen him today nor yesterday, neither. He getting too good for home folks?" "He's been out at the reservoir," Ralph said. "Him and that electrician, Brad Kitchener, have been looking at the power plant." He rubbed the side of his nose. "I was out this morning. Figured all those chiefs ought to have at least one Indian to order around." Mother Abigail cackled, spraying peanut fragments from her toothless mouth. "Oh, Ralph, I like you. You're a one." "Why, I like you too, Mother. Anyhow, that fellow Redmond came by. Wanted to talk to Nick about being on some kind of committee." "And what did Nick say?" "Oh, he wrote a couple of pages. But what it came down to was fine by me if it's fine by Mother Abigail." "Is it?" "Well, now, what would an old lady like myself have to say about such things?" "A lot," Ralph said in a serious, almost shocked manner. "You're the reason we're here. I guess we'll do whatever you want." "What I want is to go on living free like I always have, like an American. I just want my say when it's time for me to have it, like an American."
"Well, you'll have all of that."
"The rest feel that way, Ralph?"
"You bet they do."
"Then that's fine." She rocked serenely. "Time everyone got gone. These people lollygagging around, mostly just waiting for somebody to tell them where to squat and lean."
"Then can I go ahead?"
"With what?"
"Well, Nick and Stu asked me if I could find a printing press and maybe get her going, if they got me some electricity to run it. I said I didn't need any electricity, I'd just go down to the high school and find the biggest hand-crank mimeograph I could lay my hands on. They want some flyers."
He shook his head.
"Do they? 700? Why, we only got 400 and some here.
19 out by the gate, probably getting heat stroke while you and me chin. You go bring them in."
"I will," Ralph started away.
"Ralph?"
He turned back.
"Print 1,000, she said.
They filed in through the gate that Ralph opened, and she felt her sin, the one she thought of as the mother of sin. The father of sin was theft. Every one of the 10 commandments boiled down to thou shalt not steal. Murder was the theft of a life. Adultery, the theft of a wife. Covetousness, the secret, slinking theft that took place in the cave of the heart.
blasphemy was the theft of God's name, swiped from the house of the Lord and sent out to walk the streets like a strutting whore. She had never been much of a thief, a minor pilferer from time to time at worst. The mother of sin was pride. Pride was the female side of Satan in the human race, the quiet egg of sin, always fertile. Pride had kept Moses out of Canaan. "Who brought the water from the rock when we were thirsty?" the children of Israel asked. Moses had answered, "I did it." She had always been a proud woman, proud of the floor she washed on her hands and knees. But who had provided the hands, the knees, the very water she washed with? Proud that all her children had turned out all right, none in jail ever, none caught by the bottle, none of them frigging around on the wrong side of the sheets. But the mothers of children were the daughters of God. She was proud of her life, but she had not made her life. Pride was the curse of will, and like a woman, pride had its wiles. At 108, she had not learned all its illusions yet, or mastered its glamours. When they filed through the gate, she thought, "It's me they've come to see." And on the heels of that sin, a series of blasphemous metaphors rising unbidden in her mind. How they filed through, one by one like communicants, their young leader with his eyes mostly cast down, a light-haired woman by his side, a little boy just behind him with a dark-eyed woman whose black hair was shot with twists of gray, the others behind them in a line. The young man climbed the porch steps, but his woman stopped at the foot. His hair was long, as Ralph had said, but it was clean. He had a considerable growth of reddish-gold beard. He had a strong face with freshly etched lines of care in it, around the mouth and across the forehead. "You're really real," he said softly. "Why, I have always thought so," she said. "I am Abigail Freemantle. Most folks here just call me Mother Abigail. Welcome to our place." "Thank you," he said thickly, and she saw he was struggling with tears. "We're glad to be here. My name's Larry Underwood." She held her hand out, and he shook it lightly, with awe, and she felt that twinge of pride again, that stiff-neckedness. It was as if he thought she had a fire in her that would burn him. "I dreamed of you," he said awkwardly. She smiled and nodded, and he turned stiffly, almost stumbling. He went back down the steps, shoulders hunched. He would unwind, she thought, now that he was here and when he found out he didn't have to take the whole weight of the world on his shoulders. A man who doubts himself shouldn't have to try too hard for too long, not until he's seasoned. And this man Larry Underwood was still a little green, but she liked him. His woman, pretty little thing with eyes like violets, came next. She looked boldly at Mother Abigail, but not scornfully. "I'm Lucy Swan. Pleased to make your acquaintance." "Glad you could come by, Lucy. Would you mind if I asked, well..." Now her eyes dropped, and she began to blush furiously. 108 at last count," she said kindly. "Feels more like 216 some days." "I dreamed about you," Lucy said, and then retired in some confusion. The woman with the dark eyes and the boy came next. The woman looked at her gravely and unflinchingly. The boy's face showed frank wonder. The boy was all right, but something about the woman made her feel grave cold. "He's here," she thought. "He's come in the shape of this woman. For behold, he comes in more forms than his own. The wolf, the crow, the snake." She was not above feeling fear for herself. For one instant she felt this strange woman with the white in her hair would reach out, almost casually, and snap her neck. For Nadine Cross, the moment was a confusion. She had been all right when they came in through the gate. She had been all right until Larry had begun talking to her. Then an almost swooning sense of revulsion and terror had come over her. The old woman could... could what? Could see. Yes. She was afraid that the old woman could see inside her, to where the darkness was already planted and growing well. She was afraid the old woman would rise from her place on the porch and denounce her, demand that she leave Joe and go to those, to him, for whom she was intended. Two of them, each with their own fears, looked at each other. They measured each other. The moment was short, but it seemed very long to the two of them. "He's in her, the devil's imp," Abby Freemantle thought. "All of their power is right here," Nadine thought in her turn. "She's all they've got, although they may think differently." Joe was growing restive beside her, tugging at her hand. "Hello," she said in a thin, dead voice. "I'm Nadine Cross." The old woman said, "I know who you are." The words hung in the air, cutting suddenly through the other chatter. People turned, puzzled, to see if something was happening. "Do you?" Nadine said softly. Suddenly it seemed that Joe was her protection, her only one. "Yes, I do." She moved the boy slowly in front of her like a hostage. Joe's queer seawater eyes looked up at Mother Abigail. Nadine said, "This is Joe. Do you know him as well?" Mother Abigail's eyes remained locked on the eyes of the woman who called herself Nadine Cross, but a thin shine of perspiration had broken out on the back of her neck. "I don't think Joe's his name," she said. "And I don't think you're his mom." She dropped her eyes to the boy with something like relief, unable to suppress a queer feeling that the woman had somehow won, that she had put the little chap between them, used him to keep her from doing whatever her duty was. Ah, but it had come so sudden, and she hadn't been ready for it. "What's your name, chap?" she asked the boy. The boy struggled as if a bone were caught in his throat. "Come on, Joe," Nadine said, and put a hand on his shoulder. Joe threw it off, and that seemed to break the block. "Leo," he said with sudden force and great clarity. "Leo Rockway, that's me. I'm Leo." And he sprang into Mother Abigail's arms, laughing. That generated laughter and some applause from the crowd. Nadine became virtually unnoticed, and Abby felt again that some vital focus, some vital chance, had ebbed away. "Joe," Nadine called. Her face was remote, under control again. The boy drew away a bit from Mother Abigail and looked at her. "Come away," said Nadine. Now she looked unflinchingly at Abby, speaking not to the boy but directly at her. "She's old. You'll hurt her. She's very old and not very strong." "I love her," the boy said. Nadine seemed to flinch at that. Her voice sharpened. "Come away, Joe." "That's not my name. Leo. Leo, that's my name." The little crowd of new pilgrims quieted again, aware that something unexpected had happened, might be happening still, but unable to know what. The two women locked eyes again like sabers. "I know who you are," Abby's eyes said. Nadine's answered, "Yes, and I know you." But this time it was Nadine who dropped her eyes first. "All right," she said, "Leo, or whatever you like, just come away before you tire her." He left Mother Abigail's arms, but reluctantly. "You come back and see me whenever you want," Abby said. But she did not raise her eyes to include Nadine. "Okay," the boy said, and blew her a kiss. Nadine's face was stony. She didn't speak. As they went back down the path, the arm Nadine had around his shoulders seemed more like a drag chain than a comfort. Mother Abigail watched them go, aware that she was losing the focus again. With the woman's face out of sight, the sense of revelation began to grow fuzzy. She became unsure of what she had felt. She was only another woman, surely. Wasn't she? "He comes in more shapes than his own. Wolf, crow, snake, woman." But the thought had no power over her now. "I was sitting here complacently, waiting to be kowtowed to. Yes, that's what I was doing, no use denying it. And now that woman has come and something has happened, and I'm losing what it was. There was something about that woman, wasn't there? Are you sure? Are you sure?" There was an instant of silence, and in it they all seemed to be looking at her, waiting for her to prove herself. And she wasn't doing it. The woman and the boy were gone from sight. They had left as if they were the true believers, and she nothing but a shoddy fake. Oh, but I'm old. It's not fair.
And on the heels of that came another voice, small and low and rational, a voice that was not her own.
Not too old to know the woman is...
Now another man had approached her in hesitant, deferential fashion. "Hi, Mother Abigail," he said. "The name's Zelman, Mark Zelman, from Lowville, New York. I dreamed about you." And she was faced with a sudden choice that was clear-cut for only an instant in her groping mind. She could acknowledge this man's hello, banter with him a little to set him at his ease. Not too much at ease, that was not precisely what she wanted. And then go on to the next and the next and the next, receiving their homage like new palm leaves. Or she could ignore him and the rest. She could follow the thread of her thought down into the depths of herself, searching for whatever it was that the Lord meant her to know. The woman is...
what?
The woman is...
what?
Did it matter? The woman was gone.
"I had me a great-nephew lived in upstate New York one time," she said easily to Mark Zelman. "Town named Rouse's Point. Backed right up against Vermont on Lake Champlain, it is. Probably never heard of it, have you?"
Mark Zelman said he sure had heard of it. Just about everyone in New York State knew that town. Had he ever been there? His face broke tragically.
No, he never had. Always meant to.
"From what Ronnie wrote in his letters, you didn't miss much," she said. And Zelman went away beaming broadly. The others came up to make their manners, as the other parties had done before them, as still others would do in the days and weeks to come. A teenage boy. A fellow named Jack Jackson, who was a car mechanic. A young RN named Laurie Constable. She would come in handy. An old man named Richard Ferris, whom everyone called the Judge. He looked at her keenly and almost made her feel uncomfortable again. And a great many others. She spoke to them all, nodded, smiled, and put them at their ease. But the pleasure she had felt on other days was gone today, and she felt only the aches in her wrists and fingers and knees, plus the gnawing suspicion that she had to go use the portisan, and if she didn't get there soon, she was going to stain her dress. All of that and the feeling, fading now, that she had missed something of great significance, and she might later be very sorry. Nick Andros sat in the study of the house on Baseline Drive that he shared with Ralph Brentner and Ralph's woman, Elise. It was almost dark. The house was a beauty, sitting below the bulk of Flagstaff Mountain, but quite a bit above the town of Boulder proper, so that from the wide living room window the streets and roads of the municipality appeared spread out like a gigantic game board. That window was treated on the outside with some sort of silvery reflective stuff, so that the squire could look out, but passers-by could not look in. Nick guessed that the house was in the $150,000 to $200,000 range, and the owner and his family were mysteriously absent. On his own long journey from Shoyo to Boulder, first by himself, then with Tom Cullen and the others, he had passed through tens of dozens of towns and cities, and all of them had been stinking charnel houses. Boulder had no business being any different, but it was. There were corpses here, yes, thousands of them, and something was going to have to be done about them before the hot, dry days ended and the fall rains began, causing quicker decomposition and possible disease. But there were not enough corpses. Nick wondered if anyone other than he and Stu Redman had noticed it. Lauder, maybe. Lauder noticed almost everything. For every house or public building you found littered with corpses, there were 10 others completely empty. Sometime during the last spasm of the plague, most of Boulder's citizens, sick or well, had blown town. Why? Well, he supposed it really didn't matter, and maybe they would never know. The awesome fact remained that Mother Abigail, sight unseen, had managed to lead them to maybe the one small city in the United States that had been cleared of plague victims. It was enough to make even an agnostic like himself wonder where she was getting her information. He went back to his thoughts, doodling formlessly on a pad in front of him. It seemed to him that all they wanted or needed from the old life was stored in the silent East Boulder power plant, like dusty treasure in a dark cupboard.
An unpleasant feeling seemed to run through the people who had gathered in Boulder, a feeling just submerged below the surface. They were like a scared bunch of kids knocking around in the local haunted house after dark. There was a sense that being here in Boulder was strictly a temporary thing. There was one man, a fellow named Impening, who had lived in Boulder and worked on one of the custodial crews at the IBM plant out on the Boulder-Longmont diagonal. Impening seemed determined to stir up unrest. He was going around telling people that in 1974 there had been an inch and a half of snow in Boulder by September 14th, and that by November it would be cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey. That was the kind of talk Nick would like to put a quick stop to. Never mind that if Impening had been in the army, he would have been cashiered for such talk. That was an empty logic, if it was logic at all. The important thing was that Impening's words would have no power if people could move into houses where the lights worked and where the furnaces blew hot air up through grates at the touch of a finger on a button. If that didn't happen by the time the first cold snap arrived, Nick was afraid that people would begin to simply slip away, and all the meetings, representatives, and ratifications in the world wouldn't stop that. According to Ralph, there wasn't that much wrong at the power plant, at least not that much visible. The crews who ran it had shut some of the machinery down. Other machinery had shut itself down. Two or three of the big turbine engines had blown, perhaps as the result of some final power surge. Ralph said that some of the wiring would have to be replaced, but he thought that he and Brad Kitchener and a crew of a dozen warm bodies could do that. A much bigger work crew was needed to remove fused and blackened copper wire from the blown turbine generators and then install new copper wire by the yard. There was plenty of copper wire in the Denver supply houses for the taking. Ralph and Brad had gone one day last week to check for themselves. With the manpower, they thought they could have the lights on again by Labor Day. "And then we'll throw the biggest fucking party this town ever saw," Brad said. Law and order. That was something else that troubled him. Could Stu Redman be handed that particular package? He wouldn't want the job, but Nick thought he could perhaps persuade Stu to take it. And if push came to shove, he could get Stu's friend Glenn to back him up. What really bothered him was the memory, still too fresh and hurtful to look at more than briefly, of his own brief and terrible tour as Shoyo's jailkeeper. Vince and Billy dying, Mike Childress jumping up and down on his supper and crying out in wretched defiance, "Hunger strike! I'm on a fucking hunger strike!" It made him ache inside to think they might need courts and jails. Christ, these were Mother Abigail's people, not the Dark Man's. But he suspected the Dark Man would not bother with such trivialities as courts and jails. His punishment would be swift and sure and heavy. He would not need the threat of jail when the corpses hung on the telephone pole crosses along I-15. Nick hoped most of the infractions would be small ones. There had been several cases of drunk and disorderly already. One kid, really too young to drive, had been rodding a big dragging machine up and down Broadway, scaring people out of the street. He had finally driven into a stalled bread truck and had gashed his forehead. Unlucky to get off so cheaply, in Nick's opinion. The people who had seen him knew he was too young, but no one had felt he or she had the authority to put a stop to it. Authority. Organization. He wrote the words on his pad and put them inside a double circle. Being Mother Abigail's people gave them no immunity to weakness, stupidity, or bad companions. Nick didn't know if they were the children of God or not, but when Moses had come down from the mountain, those not busy worshipping the golden calf had been busy shooting craps, he knew that. And they had to face the possibility that someone might get cut over a card game, or decide to shoot someone else over a woman. Authority. Organization. He circled the words again, and now they were like prisoners behind a triple stockade. How well they went together, and what a sorry sound they made. Not long after, Ralph came in to show Nick a sample poster. Still smelling strongly of mimeograph ink, the print was large and eye-catching. Ralph had done the graphics himself. Mass meeting. Representative board to be nominated and elected. 8:30 p.m., August 18th, 1980. Place, Canyon Boulevard Park and Bandshell, if fine. Chautauqua Hall and Chautauqua Park, if foul. Refreshments will be served following the meeting. Below this were two rudimentary street maps for newcomers and those who hadn't spent much time exploring Boulder. Below, in rather fine print,
were the names he and Stu and Glenn had agreed upon after some discussion earlier in the day. Ad hoc committee. Nick Andros, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, Richard Ellis, Fran Goldsmith, Stuart Redman, Susan Stern.
"Spent some time talking with the fellow in charge of that big group that came in today," Ralph said after Nick had nodded his approval and handed the flyer back. "Larry Underwood, his name is. Smart man, Nick. Sharp. He's 5 or 6 years older than you and maybe 5 years younger than Redmond. He's the kind of man you've been looking for. Wish we had room for him on this committee thing. You'd like him."
Nick shrugged. It was too late now. He and the others had been finalizing the committee even as Larry and his party were meeting Mother Abigail. He pointed to the line on the flyer about refreshments and raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, yeah, well, Franny came by and said we'd be more apt to get everybody if we had something. She and a friend there, Patty Kroger, they're going to see to it. Cookies and Zyrex."
Ralph made a face.
"If it came down to a choice between drinking Zyrex and bull piss, I'd have to sit down and think her over. You can have mine, Nicky."
Nick grinned.
"The only thing about this," Ralph went on more seriously, "is you guys put me on this committee. I know what that word means. It means congratulations, you get to do all the hard work."
"Well, I don't really mind that. I've been working hard all my life. But committees are supposed to have ideas, and I ain't much of an idea man."
On his pad, Nick quickly sketched a big CB setup, and in the background, a radio tower with bolts of electricity coming from its top.
"Yeah, but that's a lot different," Ralph said glumly.
"You'll be fine," Nick wrote. "Believe it."
"If you say so, Nicky, I'll give her a try. I still think you'd be better off with this Underwood fellow, though."
Nick clapped Ralph on the shoulder. Ralph bid him good night and went upstairs. When he was gone, Nick looked thoughtfully at the handbill for a long time. If Stu and Glenn had seen copies, and he was sure they had by now, they knew that he had unilaterally stricken Harold Lauder's name from their list of ad hoc committee members. He didn't know how they might be taking it, but the fact that they hadn't shown up at his door yet was probably a good sign. They might want him to do some horse trading of his own, and if he had to, he would do it, just to keep Harold out at the top. If he had to, he would give them Ralph. Ralph didn't really want the position anyway, although, goddammit, Ralph had great native wit and the nearly priceless ability to think around the corners of problems. He would be a good man to have on the permanent committee, and he felt that Stu and Glenn had already packed the committee with their friends. If he wanted Lauder out, they would just have to go along. To pull off this leadership coup smoothly, there had to be no dissension at all among them, and they would have to be constantly thinking 3 steps ahead. After love, Stu had gone to sleep. He had been on short sleep rations lately, and the night before he had been up all night with Glenn Bateman, planning for the future. Franny had put on her robe and had come out here on the balcony. The building they lived in was downtown, on the corner of Pearl Street and Broadway. Their apartment was on the 3rd floor, and below her she could see the intersection, Pearl running east-west, Broadway running north-south. She liked it here. They had the compass boxed. The night was warm and windless, the black stone of the sky floored with 1,000,000 stars. In their faint and frosty glow, Fran could see the slabs of the Flatirons rising in the west. She passed a hand down from her neck to her thighs. The dressing gown she wore was silk, and she was naked underneath. Her hand passed smoothly over her breasts, and then, instead of continuing on flat and straight to the mild rise of her pubis, her hand traced an arc of belly, following a curve that had not been this pronounced even 2 weeks ago. She was beginning to show, not a lot yet, but Stu had commented on it this evening. His question had been casual enough, even comic. "How long can we do it without me, squeezing him?" "Or her," she had answered, amused. "How does 4 months sound, Chief?"
"Fine," he had answered, and slipped deliciously into her.
Earlier, talk had been much more serious. Not long after they got to Boulder, Stu told her he had discussed the baby with Glenn, and Glenn had advanced the idea, very cautiously, that the superflu germ or virus might still be around. If so, the baby might die. It was an unsettling thought. You could always, she thought, count on Glenn Bateman for an unsettling thought or two. But surely if the mother was immune, the baby... Yet there were plenty of people here who had lost children to the plague.
Yes, but that would mean... Would mean what? Well, for one thing, it might mean that all these people here were just an epilogue to the human race. A brief coda. She didn't want to believe that, couldn't believe it. If that were... Someone was coming up the street, turning sideways to slip between a dump truck that had stalled with two of its wheels on the pavement and the wall of a restaurant called the Pearl Street Kitchen. He had a light jacket slung over one shoulder and was carrying something in one hand that was either a bottle or a gun with a long barrel. In the other hand, he had a sheet of paper, probably with an address written on it from the way he was checking street numbers. At last he stopped in front of their building. He was looking at the door and trying to decide what to do. Franny was standing less than 20 feet above his head, and she found herself in one of those situations. If she called to him, she might scare him. If she didn't, he might start knocking and wake Stuart up. And what was he doing with a gun in his hand anyway, if it was a gun? He suddenly craned his neck and looked up, probably to see if any lights were on. Franny was still looking down. They peered directly into each other's eyes. "Holy God!" the man on the sidewalk cried. He took an involuntary step backward, went off the sidewalk into the gutter, and sat down hard. "Oh!" Franny said at the same moment, and took her own step backward on the balcony. There was a spider plant in a large pottery vase on a pedestal behind her. Franny's behind struck it. It tottered, almost decided to live a little longer, and then defenestrated itself on the balcony's slate flags with a loud crash. In the bedroom, Stu grunted, turned over, and was still again. Franny, perhaps predictably, was seized with the giggles. She put both hands over her mouth and pinched viciously at her lips, but the giggles came out anyway in a series of hoarse little whispers. "Grace strikes again," she thought, and Whisper giggled madly into her cupped hands. "If he'd had a guitar, I could have dropped the damn bass on his head." "Oh, solo mio!" Crash! Her belly hurt from trying to hold in the giggles. A conspiratorial whisper wafted its way up from below. "Hey, you! You on the balcony! Psst!" "Psst!" Franny whispered to herself. "Psst! Oh, great!" She had to get out before she started hee-hawing away like a donkey. She had never been able to hold in her laughter once it got hold of her. She ran fleetly across the darkened bedroom, snatched a more substantial and demure wrapper from the back of the bathroom door, and went down the hall struggling it on, her face working like a rubber mask. She let herself out onto the landing and got down one flight before the laughter escaped her and flew free. She went down the lower two flights laughing wildly. The man, a young man, she now saw, had picked himself up and was brushing himself off. He was slim and well-built, most of his face covered with a beard that might be blonde or possibly sandy red by daylight. There were dark circles under his eyes, but he was smiling a rueful little smile. "What did you knock over?" he asked. "It sounded like a piano." "It was a vase," she said. It... But then the giggles caught her again, and she could only point a finger at him and laugh quietly and shake her head and then hold her aching belly again. Tears rolled down her cheeks. "You really looked funny. I know that's a hell of a thing to say to somebody you just met, but, oh my, you did." "If this was the old days," he said, grinning, "my act would be to sue you for at least 250,000. Whiplash. Judge, I looked up and this young woman was peering down at me. Yes, I believe she was making a face. Her face was on, at any rate. We fine for the plaintiff, this poor boy, also for the bailiff. There will be a 10-minute recess." They laughed together a little. The young man was wearing clean, faded jeans and a dark blue shirt. The summer night was warm and kind, and Franny was beginning to be glad she had come out. "Your name wouldn't happen to be Fran Goldsmith, would it?"
"It so happens, but I don't know you."
"Larry Underwood, we just came in today. Actually, I was looking for a fellow named Harold Lauder. They said he was living at 261 Pearl along with Stuart Redman and Franny Goldsmith and some other people." That dried her giggles up. "Harold was in the building when we first got to Boulder, but he split quite a while ago. He's on Arapaho now, on the west side of town. I can give you his address if you want it, and directions." "I'd appreciate that, but I'll wait until tomorrow to go over, I guess. I'm not risking this action again." "Do you know Harold?" she asked.
"I do and I don't," Larry said. "The same way I do and don't know you. Although I have to be honest and say you don't look the way I pictured you. In my mind, I saw you as a Valkyrie-type blonde right out of a Frank Frazetta painting, probably with a 45 on each hip. But I'm pleased to meet you anyway. He stuck out his hand, and Franny shook it with a bewildered little smile. I'm not getting you. Sit down on the curb a minute, and I'll tell you. She sat. A ghost of a breeze riffled up the street, shuffling scraps of paper and making the old elms move on the courthouse lawn. He held up the long-barreled gun, and it wasn't a gun at all. It was a wine bottle with a long neck. She tilted the label to the starlight and could just barely read the large print. Bordeaux at the top, and at the bottom the date, 1947. The best vintage Bordeaux in this century, he said. At least that's what an old friend of mine used to say. His name was Rudy, God love his soul. That's for Harold? That and something else, he said. He took something out of his jacket pocket and handed it to her. She didn't have to turn this up to the starlight to read the print, large orange letters outlined with blue. She burst out laughing. A payday candy bar, she exclaimed. Harold's... But how would you know that? That's the story. Then tell me. Well then, once upon a time there was a fellow named Larry Underwood, who, for various reasons, had to leave California in a hurry. He came to New York where his mother lived, and behold, the Wicked Witch of the West, or some Pentagon assholes, visited the country with a great plague, and before you could say, here comes Captain Trips, just about everyone in New York was dead. Now, Larry was one of the lucky ones. He made it out of the city with a lady named Rita, who wasn't very well equipped to deal with what had happened. And unfortunately, Larry wasn't very well equipped to help her deal with it. No one had the equipment. But some developed it quicker than others. Anyhow, Larry and Rita headed for the coast of Maine. They made it as far as Vermont, and the lady OD'd on sleeping pills. Oh, Larry, that is too bad. Larry took it very personally. In fact, he took it as a personal judgment on his strength of character. In fact, he had been told by one or two people who should have known that his most incorruptible character trait was a splendid streak of self-interest, which came shining through like a day-glow Madonna sitting on the dashboard of a 59 Cadillac. Franny shifted a bit on the curb. I hope I'm not making you uncomfortable, but all of this has been sloshing around inside for a long time. Larry continued on to Maine because there didn't seem to be any place else to go. He was having very bad dreams by then, but since he was alone, he had no way of knowing that other people were having them too. He simply assumed it was another symptom of his continuing mental breakdown. But eventually he made it to a small coastal town named Wells, where he met a woman named Nadine Cross and a boy whose name turns out to be Leo Rockway. Wells, she marveled softly. Anyway, the three travelers sort of flipped a coin to see which way they should head on US 1, and since it came up tails, they headed down south, where they eventually came to... A gun quit, Franny said, delighted. Just so. There on a barn in huge letters, I made my first acquaintance with Harold Lauder and Francis Goldsmith. Harold's sign! Oh, Larry, he will be pleased! We followed the directions on the barn to Stovington, and the directions at Stovington to Nebraska, and the directions at Mother Abigail's house to Boulder. We met people along the way. One of them was a girl named Lucy Swan, who's my woman. I'd like you to meet her sometime. I think you'd like her. By then, something had happened that Larry didn't really want. His little party of four grew to six. The six met four more in upstate New York, and our party absorbed theirs. By the time we made it to Harold's sign in Mother Abigail's dooryard, there were 16 of us, and we picked up another three just as we were leaving. Larry was in charge of this brave band. There was no vote or anything like that, it just was. And he really didn't want the responsibility. It was a drag, it was keeping him awake nights. He started popping Tums and Rolaids. But it's funny the way your mind boxes your mind. I couldn't let it go. And he was always afraid he was going to fuck it up righteously, and that he'd get up some morning and someone would be dead in their sleeping bag the way Rita was that time in Vermont, and everyone would be standing around pointing their fingers and saying, it's your fault. You didn't know any better, and it's your fault. And that was something I couldn't talk about, not even to the judge. Who's the judge? Judge Ferris, an old guy from Peoria. I guess he really was a judge at one time back in the early 50s, circuit judge or something, but he'd been retired a long time when the flu hit. He's plenty sharp, though. When he looks at you, you'd swear he has X-ray eyes. Anyhow, Harold was important to me. He got to be more important as there got to be more people, In direct ratio, you might say. He chuckled a little.
That barn. Man, the last line of that sign, the one with your name, was so low I figured he really must have been hanging ass out to the wind when he painted it on.
Yes, I was sleeping when he did that. I would have made him stop.
I started to get a sense of him, Larry said. I found a payday wrapper in the cupola of that barn in Ogunquit, and then the carving on the beam.
What carving?
She felt that Larry was studying her in the dark, and she pulled her robe a little closer around her. Not a gesture of modesty, because she felt no threat from this man, but one of nervousness.
Just his initials, Larry said casually. H-E-L.
If that had been the end of it, I wouldn't be here now.
But then at the motorcycle dealership in Wells, we were there.
Oh, I know you were. I saw a couple of bikes gone.
What made an even bigger impression was that Harold had siphoned some gas from the underground tank.
You must have helped him, Fran. I damn near lost my fingers.
No, I didn't have to. Harold hunted around until he found something he called a plug vent.
Larry groaned and slapped his forehead.
Plug vent? Jesus, I never even looked for where they were venting the tank. You mean he just hunted around, pulled a plug, and put his hose in?
Well, yes.
Oh, Harold, Larry said in a tone of admiration that she had never heard before, at least not in connection with Harold Lauder's name.
Well, that's one of his tricks I missed. Anyway, we got to Stovington, and the dean was so upset she fainted.
I cried, Fran said. I bawled until it seemed I'd never stop. I just had my mind made up that when we got there, someone would welcome us in and say, "Hi, step right inside. Cafeteria's on your left."
She shook her head.
That seems so silly now.
I was not dismayed. Dauntless Harold had been there before me, left his sign, and gone on. I felt like a tenderfoot Easterner following that Indian from the Pathfinder.
His view of Harold both fascinated and amazed her. Hadn't Stu really been leading the party by the time they left Vermont and struck out for Nebraska? She couldn't honestly remember. By then, they had all been preoccupied with the dreams. Larry was reminding her of things she had forgotten, or worse, had taken for granted. Harold risking his life to put that sign on the barn, it had seemed like a foolish risk to her, but it had done some good after all. And getting gas from that underground tank. It had apparently been a major operation for Larry, but Harold had seemed to take it purely as a matter of course. It made her feel small, and it made her feel guilty. They all more or less assumed that Harold was nothing but a grinning supernumerary. But Harold had turned quite a few tricks in the last 6 weeks. Had she been so much in love with Stu that it took this total stranger to point out some home truths about Harold? What made the feeling even more uncomfortable was the fact that, once he had gotten his feet under him, Harold had been completely adult about herself and Stuart. Larry said, "So here's another neat sign, complete with route numbers at Stovington, right?" And fluttering in the grass next to it, another payday candy wrapper. I felt like instead of following broken sticks and bent grasses, I was following Harold's trail of paydays. "Well, we didn't follow your route the whole way. We bent north near Gary, Indiana, because there was one hell of a fire, still burning in places. It looked like every damn oil tank in the city went up. Anyhow, we picked up the judge on the detour, stopped by Hemingford home. We knew she was gone by then, the dreams, you know, but we all wanted to see that place just the same. The corn, tire swing. You know what I mean?"
"Yes," Franny said quietly. "Yes, I do."
"And all the time I'm going crazy thinking that something is going to happen. We're going to get attacked by a motorcycle gang or something. Run out of water, I don't know. There used to be a book my mom had. She got it from her grandmother or something. In His Steps, that was the name of it. And there were all these little stories about guys with horrible problems, ethical problems, most of them. And the guy who wrote the book said that to solve the problems, all you had to do was ask, 'What would Jesus do?' It always cleared the trouble right up. You know what I think? It's a Zen question. Not really a question at all, but a way to clear your mind, like saying Om and looking at the tip of your nose. So when I really started to get wound up, Lucy, that's my girl, did I tell you? Lucy would say, 'Hurry up, Larry, ask the question.'
'What would Jesus do?' Fran said, amused.
No, what would Harold do? Larry answered seriously. Fran was nearly dumbfounded. She could not help wishing to be around when Larry actually met Harold. Whatever in the world would his reaction be? We camped in this farmyard one night, and we were really almost out of water. The place had a well, but no way of drawing it up, naturally, because the power was off and the pump wouldn't work. And Leo kept walking by and saying, "Firsty, Larry, pretty firsty now," and he was driving me bug shit. I could feel myself tightening up, and the next time he came by, I probably would have hit him. Nice guy, huh? Getting ready to hit a disturbed child. But a person can't change all at once. I've had plenty of time to work that out for myself. "I'd say you've done pretty well," Fran murmured. "Harold and I did pretty well," he corrected. "Anyway, Lucy said, 'Quick, Larry, ask the question.' So I did. There was a windmill on the place that ran water up to the barn. It was turning pretty good, but there wasn't any water coming out of the barn faucets either. So I opened the big case at the foot of the windmill, where all the machinery was, and I saw that the main drive shaft had popped out of its hole. I got it back in, and bingo, all the water you could want, thanks to Harold." "Thanks to you? Harold wasn't really there, Larry." "Well, he was in my head, and now I'm here, and I brought him the wine and the candy bars." He didn't say anything for a long time, but she felt him looking at her. At last he said, "Okay, how have I got it wrong about Harold?" She stood up. "I ought to go in now. It's been nice to meet you, Larry. Come by tomorrow and meet Stu. Bring your Lucy if she's not busy." "What is it about him?" he insisted, standing with her. "Oh, I don't know," she said thickly. Suddenly the tears were very close. "You make me feel as if I treated Harold very shabbily, and I don't know why or how I did it. Can I be blamed for not loving him the way I do Stu? Is that supposed to be my fault?" "No, of course not." Larry looked taken aback. Listen, I'm sorry. I barged in on you. I'll go." "He's changed," Franny burst out. "I don't know how or why, and sometimes I think it might be for the better. But I don't really know, and sometimes I'm afraid." "Afraid of Harold?" She didn't answer, only looked down at her feet. She thought she had already said too much. "You were going to tell me how I could get there," he asked gently. "It's easy. Just go straight out Arapahoe until you come to the little park, the Eben G. Fine Park, I think it is. The park's on the right. Harold's little house is on the left, just across from it." "All right. Thanks. Meeting you was a pleasure, Fran, busted base and all." She smiled, but it was perfunctory. All of the dizzy good humor had gone out of the evening. Larry raised the bottle of wine and offered his slanted little smile. "And if you see him before I do, keep a secret, huh?" "Sure. Night, Franny." He walked back the way he had come. She watched him out of sight, then went upstairs and slipped into bed next to Stu, who was still out like a light. "Harold," she thought, pulling the covers up to her chin. How was she supposed to tell this Larry that Harold Lauder was fat and juvenile and lost himself? Was she supposed to tell him that the sometimes sulky, often frightened Harold that had come to Boulder from Ogunquit had turned into a stout politician, a backslapper, a hail fellow well-met type of guy who nonetheless looked at you with the flat and unsmiling eyes of a Gila monster? She thought her wait for sleep might be very long tonight. Harold had fallen hopelessly in love with her, and she had fallen hopelessly in love with Stu Redman, and it certainly was a tough old world. And now every time I see Harold, I get such a case of the creeps. Even though he looks like he's lost 10 pounds or so, and he doesn't have quite so many pimples, I get the... Her breath caught audibly in her throat, and she sat up on her elbows, eyes wide in the dark. Something had moved inside her. Her hands went to the slight swelling of her middle. Surely it was too early. It had only been her imagination, except it hadn't been. She lay back down slowly, her heart beating hard. She almost woke Stu up and then didn't. If only he had put the baby inside her instead of Jess. If he had, she would have awakened him and shared the moment with him. And then the movement came again, so slight it might only have been gas. Except she knew better. It was the baby. and the baby was alive. "Oh, glory," she murmured to herself, and lay back. Larry Underwood and Harold Lauder were forgotten. Everything that had happened to her since her mother had fallen ill was forgotten. She waited for it to move again, listening for that presence inside herself, and fell asleep still listening. Her baby was alive. Harold sat in a chair on the lawn of the little house he had picked out for himself, looking up at the sky and thinking of an old rock and roll song. He hated rock, but he could remember this one almost line for line, and even the name of the group that had sung it, Kathy Young and the Innocents. The lead singer, songstress, whatever, had a high, yearning, reedy voice that had somehow caught his full attention. A golden goody, the DJs called it. The girl singing lead sounded 16 years old, pallid, blonde, and plain. She sounded as if she might be singing to a picture that spent most of its time buried in a dresser drawer, a picture that was taken out only late at night when everyone else was asleep. She sounded hopeless. The picture she sang to had perhaps been clipped from her big sister's yearbook, a picture of the local big jock, captain of the football team and president of the student council. The big jock would be slipping it to the head cheerleader on some deserted lover's lane, while far away in suburbia this plain girl with no breasts and a pimple in the corner of her mouth sang, "A thousand stars in the sky make me realize you are the one that I'll adore. Tell me you love me. Tell me you're mine, all mine." There were a lot more than 1,000 stars in his sky tonight, but they weren't lover's stars. No soft call of Milky Way here. Here, a mile above sea level, they were as sharp and cruel as a billion holes in black velvet, a piece of black velvet with some unknowable light shining behind it. They were haters' stars. And because they were, Harold felt well qualified to wish on them. Wish I may, wish I might, have the wish I wish tonight. Harold's hair was longer than ever, but it was no longer dirty and clotted and tangled. He no longer smelled like a shoot-off in a haymow. Even his blemishes were clearing up, now that he had laid off the candy. And with the hard work and all the walking, he was losing some weight. He was starting to look pretty good. He shifted in his chair. There was a book in his lap, a tall volume with a marbled blue binding and imitation leather covers. He kept it hidden under a loose hearthstone in the house when he was away. If anyone found the book, that would be the end of him in Boulder. There was one word stamped in gold leaf on the book's cover, and the word was ledger. It was the journal he had started after reading Fran's diary. Already he had filled the first 60 pages with his close, margin-to-margin handwriting. There were no paragraphs, only a solid block of writing, an outpouring of hate like pus from a skin abscess. He hadn't thought he had so much hate in him. It seemed he should have exhausted the flow by now, yet it seemed he had only tapped it. It was like that old joke. Why was the ground all white after Custer's last stand? Because the Indians kept coming and coming and... And why did he hate? That was a hard question to answer, except maybe to a few, a chosen few. Hadn't Einstein said there were only 6 people in the world who understood all the implications of E equals MC squared? What about the equation inside his own skull? The relativity of Harold? The speed of blight? Oh, he could fill twice as many pages as he had already written about that, becoming more obscure, more arcane, until he finally became lost in the clockwork of himself and still nowhere near the mainspring at all. He was, perhaps, raping himself. Was that it? It was close, anyway. An obscene and ongoing act of buggery. The Indians just kept on coming and coming. He would be leaving Boulder soon, anyway. A month or two, no more. When he finally settled on a method of settling his scores, then he would head out west. And when he got there, he would open his mouth and spill his guts about this place. He would tell them what went on at the public meetings, and much more important, what went on at the private meetings. He was sure to be on the Free Zone Committee. He would be well rewarded by the fellow in charge over there, not by an end to hate, but by the perfect vehicle for it, a hate Cadillac, a Fear Dorado, long and darkly shining. He would climb into it, and it would bear him and his hate down on them. He and Flagg would kick this miserable settlement apart like an anthill. But first he would settle with Redman, who had lied to him and stolen his woman. "Yes, Harold, but why do you hate?" There had been a time, an hour or an instant, when he had contemplated jettisoning the hate. That had been after he had finished reading Fran's diary and discovered she was irrevocably committed to Stu Redmond. That sudden knowledge had acted upon him the way a dash of cold water acts on a slug, causing it to contract into a tight little ball instead of a spread-out, loosely questing organism. In that hour or instant, he became aware that he could simply accept what was, and that knowledge had both exhilarated and terrified him. For that space of time, he knew he could turn himself into a new person, a fresh Harold Lauder cloned from the old one by the sharp intervening knife of the superflu epidemic. He sensed, more clearly than any of the others, that that was what the Boulder Free Zone was all about. People were not the same. This small-town society was like no other in American pre-plague society. They didn't see it because they didn't stand outside the boundaries as he did. Men and women were living together with no apparent desire to reinstitute the ceremony of marriage. Whole groups of people were living together in small sub-communities like communes. There wasn't much fighting. People seemed to be getting along. And strangest of all, none of them seemed to be questioning the profound theological implications of the dreams, and of the plague itself. Boulder itself was a cloned society, a tabula so rasa that it could not sense its own novel beauty. Harold sensed it, and hated it. Far away over the mountains was another cloned creature, a cutting from the dark malignancy, a single wild cell taken from the dying corpus of the old body politic, a lone representative of the carcinoma that had been eating the old society alive. One single cell, but it had already begun to reproduce itself and spawn other wild cells. For society, it would be the old struggle, the effort of healthy tissue to reject the malignant incursion. But for each individual cell, there was the old, old question, the one that went back to the garden, that of free will. Over there in the West, all the old hates and fears were spawning themselves. The assassins of Eden were there, the dark fusiliers. And he himself, when faced with the knowledge that he was free to accept what was, had, of his own free will, rejected the new opportunity. To seize it would have been to murder himself. The ghost of every humiliation he had ever suffered cried out against it. His murdered dreams and ambitions came back to eldritch life and asked if he could forget them so easily. In the new free zone society, he could only be Harold Lauder citizen. Over there he could be a prince. The malignancy drew him. It was a dark carnival, Ferris wheels with their lights out revolving above a black landscape, a never-ending sideshow filled with freaks like himself, and in the main tent the lions ate the spectators. What called him was this discordant music of chaos. He opened his journal and by starlight wrote firmly. He opened his journal and by starlight wrote firmly. August 12, 1980, early morning. It is said that the two great human sins are pride and hate. Are they? I like to think of them as the two great virtues. To give away pride and hate is to say you will change for the good of the world. To embrace them, to vent them, is more noble. That is to say that the world must change for the good of you. I am on a great adventure. Harold Emery Lauder. He closed the book. He went into the house, put the book in its hole in the hearth, and carefully replaced the hearthstone. He went into the bathroom, set his Coleman lamp on the sink so that it illuminated the mirror, and for the next 15 minutes he practiced smiling. He was getting very good at it.